Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today, we are talking about book 12, chapter 12. Nearly the end of the book. Could Mitya be found innocent was the only question I had for you. I am Norwegian, said the defence, turning the argument against Smurdy being the only other person Dimitri could have accused on its head was really good. I wonder what the standard required for the verdict was in the newly reformed Russian legal system. Did they have something akin to reasonable doubt? Did they have presumption of innocence? If so, I could see Dmitri being convicted for the assault of Grigory, but maybe escape the conviction for the murder of Fyodor. Yep, cool. Well, I don't really know either how their legal system works. But there's so much of it seems to be based on speculation and witness sort of statements, evidence. What's the word I'm looking for? Oh, it doesn't matter. Not hard evidence, but just what people say. Like Alyosha talking about where he tapped himself on the chest. And first of all, like him. Even if they do believe him. They do draw the conclusion that if he tapped on his chest in a particular place, then that would mean that he's innocent. Even if they draw that conclusion, they still would have to take his word for it that he did tap his chest there. So there's just so much speculation. Like, if they choose to believe that he's telling the truth and then choose to take that leap of if that's the case and he was tapping his chest here, then it does mean he didn't murder him. I don't know. There's just too many leaps. Uncle Josimeyer said, the novel is getting to its end, and now we have a global view of the story and what it is about. Time to ask, is there a constant element in the story? Is there an important symbol or situation that we can often see along in the novel? Sorry, I got distracted by one second there. Well, it is curious that what began as an unsolved family dispute in Zosimus Monastery ended up as a murder case fought in a courtroom and gaining the attention of the whole nation. What I see here is a theme of man versus authority, or more precisely authority versus man, a constant questioning to authority. The prevalent elements are the judgment of law and society pending over the characters. Are these judgments right? In the poem The Grand Inquisitor, we have again this theme of authority versus man. Is it right, the reasoning of the Inquisitor, to condemn Christ? Is it right, the reasoning of the prosecutor, to condemn Dmitri? Is Dostoevsky questioning law and authority? What about society? Katya's reputation is hurted, while Grushenka's is smeared. Is society represented by Madame Holokov, headless, absent-minded, fickle? One day admires Zosima, the next day she is disappointed. Mother of a neglected daughter and potential monster, new generation, courted by Rakitin, a man who seeks desperately to conquer society, but society rejects him. Is Ivan questioning God's judgment or his authority? Is the man trapped in an unfair universe, suffering both the mercilessness of God and the imperfect outcome of human laws? Is there any light at the end of this tunnel? I think Dostoevsky is not asking all these questions with arrogance or anger. He reminds us through Zosima that we all must confess humble and guilty, and that we only have each other, and we need to take care of each other with love and forgiveness. That is the answer to injustice. I am Norwegian, said, I think you're right about a few things, especially Holokov representing society at large, or perhaps polite society. But I think the book is about ideas and belief primarily, and their consequences both in society but also for the individual. Can you have faith in the modern world? What happens without faith? What is the cost of materialism? Sorry. My phone is doing phone things and I was getting distracted by it. What was I saying? What is the cost of materialism? How do progressive people use science and its theories? How can you remain a Christian in the face of science and suffering, in the face of God dying? Most of the characters deal with these issues, some more than others, but these themes are always present in the book. I keep coming back to the last speech of Father Pazzi because I think it's truly encapsulates the book. You don't have to read it again. And the TLDR version is God is pretty much dead. But also that people don't have ideas, ideas have people, so there's still a heartbeat along as long as people act out Christianity. Yep, cool. I won't read it again, but those two distillations is this where those little bromides took root? God is pretty much dead. Nietzsche said it, right? Is he just inspired by this Dostoy book? And people don't have ideas, ideas have people is another kind of old gem, which I quite like too. I suppose maybe there is some value in the lessons in this book after all. All right, let's move on and read the next chapter, shall we? I think we've discussed that as much as we can. It's called Chapter 13, A Corrupter of Thought. It's not only the accumulation of facts that threatens my clients with ruin, gentlemen of the jury. He began, what is really damning for my client is one fact, the dead body of his father. Had it been an ordinary case of murder, you would have rejected the charge in view of the triviality, the incompleteness, and the fantastic character of the evidence. If you examine each part of it separately, or at least you would have hesitated to ruin a man's life simply from the prejudice against him, which he has, alas, only too well deserved. But it's not an ordinary case of murder, it's a case of parricide that impresses men's minds, and to such a degree that the very triviality and incompleteness of the evidence becomes less trivial and less incomplete even to an unprejudiced mind. How can such a prisoner be acquitted? What if he committed the murder and gets off unpunished? That is what everyone, almost involuntarily, instinctively, feels at heart. Yes, it's a fearful thing to shed a father's blood. The father who has begotten me, loved me, not spared his life for me, grieved over my illness from childhood up, troubled all his life for my happiness, and has lived in my joys, in my success. To murder such a father, that's inconceivable. Gentlemen of the jury, what is a father? A real father? What is the meaning of that great word? What is the great idea in that name? We have just indicated, in part, what a true father is and what he ought to be. In the case in which we are now so deeply occupied and over which our hearts are aching, in the present case, the father Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov did not correspond to that conception of a father to which we have just referred. That's the misfortune, and indeed some fathers are a misfortune. Let us examine this misfortune rather more closely. We must shrink from nothing. Gentlemen of the jury, considering the importance of the decision you have to make, it's our particular duty not to shrink from any idea like the children of frightened or frightened women, as the talented prosecutor happily expresses it. But in the course of his heated speech, my esteemed opponent, and he was my opponent before I opened my lips, exclaimed several times, oh, I will not yield the defense of the prisoner to the lawyer who has come down from Petersburg. I accuse, but also I defend. He who has come from Petersburg, he exclaimed that several times, but forgot to mention that if this terrible prisoner was for 23 years so grateful for a mere pound of nuts given him by the only man who had been kind to him as a child in his father's house, might not such a man well have remembered for 23 years how he ran in his father's backyard without boots on his feet and with his little trousers hanging by one button? By one button, to use the expression of the kind-hearted Dr. Herzenstube. Oh, gentlemen of the jury, why need we look more closely at this misfortune? Why repeat what we all know already? What did my client meet with when he arrived here at his father's house, and why depict my client as a heartless egoist and monster? He is uncontrolled, he is wildly and unruly. We are trying him now for that, but who is responsible for his life? Who is responsible for having received such an unseemly bringing up in spite of his excellent disposition and his grateful and sensitive heart? Did anyone train him to be reasonable? Was he enlightened by study? Did anyone love him ever so little in his childhood? My client was left to the care of Providence, like a beast of the field. He thirsted perhaps to see his father after long years of separation. A thousand times perhaps he may, recalling his childhood, have driven away the loathsome phantoms that haunted his childhood dreams, and with his heart he may have longed to embrace and to forgive his father, and what awaited him. He was met by cynical taunts, suspicions, and wrangling by money. He heard nothing but revolting talk and vicious precepts uttered daily over the brandy, and at last he saw his father seducing his mistress from him with his own money. Oh, gentlemen of the jury, that was cruel and revolting, and that old man was always complaining of the disrespect and cruelty of his son. He slandered him in society, injured him, culminated him, bought up his unpaid debts, but to get him thrown into prison. Gentlemen of the jury, people like my client who are fierce and unruly and uncontrolled on the surface are sometimes, most frequently, indeed, exceedingly tender-hearted, only they don't express it. Don't laugh at my idea. The talented prosecutor laughed mercilessly just now at my client for loving Schiller. Loving the sublime and beautiful. I should not have laughed at that moment in his place. Yes, such natures, oh, let me speak in defense of such natures, so often and so cruelly misunderstood. These natures often thirst for senders, goodness and justice, as it were, in contrast to themselves, their unruliness, their ferocity, their thirst for unconsciously passionate and fierce on the surface. They are painfully capable of loving women, for instance, and with a spiritual and elevated love. Again, do not laugh at me, this is very often the case in such natures, but they cannot hide their passions. Sometimes are very coarse, and that is the conspicuous and is noticed, but the inner man is unseen. Their passions are quickly exhausted, but by the side of a noble and lofty creature, that seemingly coarse and rough man seeks a new life, seeks to correct himself, to be better, to become noble and honorable, sublime and beautiful. However much of the expression has been ridiculed, I said just now that I would not venture to touch upon my client's engagement, but I may say half a word. What we heard just now was not evidence, but only the scream of a frenzied and revengeful woman, and it was not for her, oh, not for her, to reproach him with treachery, but for she has betrayed him. If she had had but a little time for reflection, she would have not have given such evidence. Oh, do not believe her. No, my client is not a monster, as she called him. The lover of mankind, on the eve of his crucifixion, said, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for his sheep, so that not one of them might be lost. Let not the man's soul be lost through us. I asked just now, what does father mean, and exclaimed that it was a great word, a precious name, but one must use it honestly. Gentlemen, and I venture to call things by their right names, such as father, as of old Karamazov, cannot be called a father, and does not deserve to be. Filial love for the unworthy father is an absurdity, an impossibility. Love cannot be created from nothing. Only God can create something from nothing. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. The apostle writes from a heart glowing with love. It's not for the sake of my client that I quote these sacred words. I mention them for all fathers. Who has authorized me to preach to fathers? No one. But as a man and a citizen, I make my appeal vis a vico. We are not long on earth. We do many evil deeds, and we say many evil words, so let us all catch a favourable moment when we are all together to say a good word to each other. That's what I am going to doing. While I am in this place, I take advantage of my opportunity. Not for nothing is this tribute given us by the highest authority. All Russia hears us. I am not speaking only for the fathers here present. I cry aloud to all fathers. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. Yes, let us first fulfill Christ's injunction ourselves, and only then venture to expect it from our children. Otherwise we are not fathers, but enemies of our children, and they are not our children, but our enemies, and we have made them our enemies ourselves. What measure you meet shall be measured unto you again. It's not who I say who that, it's the gospel prospect. Measure to others according as they measure to you. How can we blame children if they measure us according to our measures? Not long ago, a servant girl in Finland was suspected of having secretly given birth to a child. She was watched, and a box of which no one knew anything was found in a corner of the loft behind some bricks. It was opened, and inside was found the body of a newborn child which she had killed. In the same box were found the skeletons of two other babies which, according to her own confession, she had killed at the same moment of their births. Gentlemen of the jury, was she a mother to her children? She gave birth to them, indeed, but was she a mother to them? Would anyone venture to give her the sacred name of mother? Let us be bold, gentlemen. Let us be audacious, even. It is our duty to be so at this moment, and not to be afraid of certain words and ideas like the Moscow women of Ostrovsky's play, who are scared at the sound of certain words. No, let us prove that the progress for the last few years has touched even us. And let us say plainly, the father is not merely he who begets the children, but he who begets it and does his duty by it. Oh, of course, there is the other meaning, there is the other interpretation of the word father, which insists that any father, even though he be a monster, even though he be the enemy of his children, still remains my father simply because he begot me. But this is, so to say, the mystical meaning of which I cannot comprehend, with my intellect, but can only accept by faith, or better to say, on faith, like many other things which I do not understand, but which religion bids me to believe. But in that case, I let it be kept outside the sphere of actual life. In the sphere of actual life, which has indeed its own rights, but also lays upon the great duties of obligations in that sphere, if we want to be humane Christian, in fact, we must or ought to act only upon convictions justified by reason and experience, which have been passed through the crucible of analysis. In a word, we must act rationally, and not as though in dream and delirium.
Then it will be real Christian work.
Not only mystic, but rational and philanthropic. There was violent applause at this passage from many parts of the court, but Fetyukovich waved his hands as though imploring them to let him violent applause, as if to let them finish without interruption. The court relapsed into silence at once. The orator went on from violent applause to instant silence. Do you suppose, gentlemen, that our children, as they grow up and begin to reason, can avoid such questions? No, they cannot, and we will not impose on them an impossible restriction. The sight of an unworthy father involuntarily suggests tormenting questions to a young creature, especially when he compares it with the excellent fathers of his companions. The conventional answer to the question is, he begot you, and he is of flesh and blood, and therefore are bound to love him. The youth involuntarily reflects, but does he love me? He begot me, he asks, wondering more and more. Was it for my sake that he begot me? He did not know, not even my sex at that moment. At that moment of passion, perhaps inflamed by wine, and he was only transmitted to me a propensity to drunkenness. That's all he has done to me. Why am I bound to love him simply for begetting me, when he has cared nothing for me all of my life after? Oh, perhaps these questions strike you as coarse and cruel, but do not expect an impossible restraint from a young mind. Drive nature out of the door, and it will fly in at the window. And above all, let us not be afraid of words, but decide the question according to the dictates of reason and humanity, and not of mystic ideas. How shall it be decided? Why, like this, let the son stand before his father and ask him, Father, tell me, why must I love you? Father, show me that I must love you. And if the father is able to answer him and show him a good reason, we have a real normal parental relation, not resting on mystical prejudice, but on a rational, responsible, and strictly humanitarian basis. But if he does not, there's an end to the family tie. He is not a father to him, and the son has a right to look upon him as a stranger and even an enemy. Our tribune, gentlemen of the jury, ought to be a school or true and sound ideas. Here the orator was interrupted by irrepressible and almost frantic applause. Of course, it was not the whole audience, but a good half of it applauded. The fathers and mothers present applauded. Shrieks and exclamations were heard from the gallery. There, ladies sitting, handkerchiefs were waved. The prisoner began ringing the bell with all his might. He was obviously irritated by the behaviour of the audience, but did not venture to clear the court as he threatened. Even persons of high position, old men, styles on the breast, sitting in the special reserved seats behind the judges, applauded the orator and waved their handkerchiefs, so that when the noise died down, the president confined himself to repeating his stern threat to clear the court. And Fetyukovich, excited and triumphant, continued his speech. Gentlemen of the jury, you remember that awful night of which so much of us has been said today, when the son got over the fence and stood face to face with the enemy and the prosecutor who had begot him. I insist most emphatically that it was not for money he ran to his father's house. The charge of robbery is an absurdity, as I proved before, and it was not to murder him he broke into the house. Oh, no, if he had that design, he would at least have taken the precaution of arming himself beforehand. The brass pestle he caught up instinctively without knowing why he did it. Granted that he deceived his father by tapping at the window, granted that he made his way in, I've said already that I do not for a moment believe that legend, but let it be so. Let's suppose it for a moment, gentlemen. I swear to you by all that is holy, if it had not been his father but an ordinary enemy, he would, after running through the rooms and satisfying himself with the woman that the woman was not there, have made off post-haste without doing any harm to his rival. He would have struck him, pushed him away, perhaps nothing more, for he would had no thought and no time to spare for that. What he wanted to know was where she was, but his father, the mere sight of his father, who had hated him for his childhood, had been his enemy, the prosecutor, and now an unnatural rival, was enough. A feeling of hatred came over him involuntarily, irresistibly clouding his reason. It all surged up in one moment in an impulse of madness and insanity, but also an impulse of nature, irresponsible, irresistible, and unconsciously, like everything in nature, avenging the violation of its eternal laws. But the prisoner even then did not murder him. I maintain that I cry that out loud. No, he only brandished the pestle in a burst of indignant disgust, not meaning to kill him, not knowing that he would kill him. Had he not had this fatal pestle in his hand, he would have only knocked his father down, perhaps, but would not have killed him. As he ran away, he did not know whether he had killed the old man. Such a murder is not a murder. Such a murder is not a parricide. No, the murder of such a father cannot be called a parricide. Such a murder can only be reckoned parricide by prejudice. But I appeal to you again and again in the depths of my soul, let this murder actually take place. Gentlemen of the jury, if we convict and punish me, we will say these people have done nothing for my bringing up, my education, nothing to improve my lot, nothing to make me better, nothing to make me a man. These people have not given me anything to eat and drink, have not visited me in prison in my nakedness, and here they say have sent me to penal servitude. I am quits. I owe them nothing and owe no one anything for ever. They are wicked and I will be wicked. They are cruel and I will be cruel. That this is what I will see. He will say, gentlemen of the jury, and I swear by finding him guilty, you will only make it easy for him, and he will consciousness, he will curse the blood he will shed, and it will no problem again. At the same time, it will destroy him, and the possibility of becoming a new man for you will remain with us wicked and blindness all his life. But do you want to punish him fearfully, terribly, with the most awful punishment that could be imagined, and at the same time save him and regenerate his soul? If so, overwhelm him with your mercy. You will see, you will hear how he will tremble to be horror-struck. How can I endure this mercy? How can I endure so much love? Am I worthy of it? That's what he will exclaim. Oh, I know, that heart, that wild but grateful heart. Gentlemen of the jury, it will bow before your mercy. It thirsts for a great and loving action. It will melt and mount upwards. There are souls which in their limitation blame the whole world, but subdue such a soul with mercy. So show it love, and it will curse its past, for there are many good impulses in it. Such a heart will expand and see that God is merciful and that men are good and just. He will be horror-stricken. He will be crushed by remorse and that vast obligation laid upon him henceforth. And he will not say, then I am quits, but he will say, I am guilty in the sight of all men and am unworthy of all that. With tears and penitence and poignant, tender anguish, he will exclaim, others are better than I. They wanted to save me, not to ruin me. Oh, this act of mercy is so easy for you, for in the absence of anything like real evidence, it will be too awful for you to pronounce, yes, he is guilty. Better acquit 10 guilty men than punish one innocent man. Do you hear the majestic voice from the past century of our glorious history? It is not for our insignificant person like me to remind you that the Russian court does not exist for the punishment only, but also for the salvation of the criminal. Let other nations think of retribution and the letter of the law. We will cling to the spirit and the meaning, the salvation and the reformation of the lost. If this is true, if Russia and her justice are such, she may go forward with good cheer. Do not try to scare us with your frenzied troikas, from which all the nations stand aside in disgust. Not a runaway troika, but the stately chariot of Russia will move calmly and majestically to its goal. In your hands is the fate of my client. In your hands is the fate of Russian injustice. Russian justice. You will defend it, you will save it, you will prove that there are men to watch over it, that it is in good hands. All right. There we go. Another chapter down. Have your say on the Reddit. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.